Orcs worship Grooms, the one-eyed god of slaughter, and our savage, bloodthirsty marauders. Today, we delve into their lore and combat mechanics to ensure the next time you run them in your games, you can get the most out of them, leaving your player characters begging for mercy. Unfortunately, Grooms doesn't give a fuck.
No.
Welcome, heroes, to the Crit Academy. I am your host, Justin.
I'm your guest, Garvin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
I'm your co-host, Brandon.
We hope to inspire you with creative content that you can bring with you on your next adventure.
I want to take a second to welcome Garwin. Thank you so much for joining us. Garwin is our Emerald patron. So one of the benefits of becoming an Emerald patron is you get to join us every 3 months or so as a guest host. So Garwin, would you like to tell the people a little bit about yourself?
Well, there's not really much to tell. I play in some of Justin's games. The Haunt a bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
Quite fun.
Yeah.
I occasionally run a bit of D&D here at home and play with you guys as well. Been doing it for, what's it been now, 4 or 5 years or so? Usually been fun.
There's a reason why we're talking about orcs today, isn't there?
Yes.
Why is that?
I do love them to an unhealthy degree.
That's an understatement.
The truth of where Orcs come from is right there. He loves orcs a little too much. So why don't you start us off with some of the basic information of the lore. Garwin's going to be feeding us tidbits of lore as we discuss the combat mechanics of the different orcs in the Monster Manual.
I'll just start this out with a quick shout out to Ruth. Love you, babe. She's in the chat.
That's a viewer.
Well, how would we do a quick questionnaire in the way to do this? A specific topic is the broad thing of all of orc kind. Anything you'd like to know about them specifically?
For me, or are you asking the audience? Because this would be a good question for audience members, too, that we can answer as we go on.
Either or.
One of the things that I've always wanted to know about orcs, obviously, they follow Grooms, but I don't think they didn't always follow Grooms. They weren't born following Grooms, is that correct?
Actually, Grooms created them, so...
Oh, is that...
Grooms created them.
I didn't know that. So, like, did he birth them from his womb or from his eye?
He looks like them.
Yep.
That's a fun question.
What is orcs cooking like? Ooh, that's a good one, Alex. Bomb.
Well, that depends on the orc. Gray orcs, they're a bit more sophisticated. They might have some seasoning here and there, but all orcs are carnivorous. They don't have any greenery. They just can't digest it properly. Funnily enough, though, unlike normal monsters, they actually prefer normal game meat and not humanoids. They find humanoids kind of bland. Which is kind of funny when you consider the fact that, for example, mountain orc cooking, it's described as you're not sure if you're eating something that tastes like shoe or if they just threw the shoe in there.
A little extra.
I do got to add to the...
And here was Broken the Orc was saying, drow, the other dark meat.
So carrots don't taste good.
No, they don't like it.
Will
eat humanoids, you know, when they can here and there, but they don't prefer it.
That's fair.
If you've had the pleasure of buying the D&D cookbook,
orc
jerky.
They have orc bacon in there, and it is...
Oh, it's so good.
So good.
So, one of the things that's really common with orcs is they are in D&D, at least up to my knowledge, which is very limited compared to the vast font of knowledge in Garwin's brain, that they are often treated as kind of a plague on civilization. They fight amongst themselves a lot, mostly to prove strength, but sometimes to get some raid and looting in, right? But they do have a love for close combat, and they plunge, you know, furiously into the thick of battle without giving any thoughts to retreat or surrender.
Yeah. How's
very
that
often it is the case, though it depends on which god they follow more. For example, if they follow Il-Nabal, I can never get that name right. Il-Nabal. What's
who
that?
Is?
Orc? I don't remember.
No, none of us know. You're fine.
Yeah. It's the orc god of war and strategy. If they follow him, they'll have actual strategy in their fights. Like, they're the type that might have actual siege equipment, for example.
Oh.
Might actually divert their forces here or there, might split apart to come behind the enemy while distracting them over there. When an orc priest of Il-Nabal appears in an orc horde, their strategies get, if not to human levels, then maybe a little beyond it sometimes too, depending on his proficiency.
Yeah, that you actually pointed out something really interesting there, that they specialize in like siege equipment. That's not something that I've ever actually thought about in my campaigns with orcs. I don't think I've ever given them a catapult, but I just love the idea of them flinging like corpses of the dead people they've slain back at the enemies they're attacking. Like, hey, you lost your guard. Here's a pack. Because
one of my favorite tactics is when you have, for example, mountain orcs. They're one of the few main orc races that actually use animals and monsters, but they don't train them. They believe that by training them, they take the savagery out of them. So they just have wild monsters of any kind you can find in mountains or hills, everywhere from like low tier dragons to manticores or something. One of my favorite tactics is probably taking a catapult or a trebuchet, strapping it to a mammoth, and having the orcs ride the wild creature to battle while tossing stones and whatnot.
Oh, that's cool.
So they do need orcs with them in the colony to actually make that equipment. Right. Mountain orcs are too dumb to actually make this kind of stuff.
And so we're clear.
But if they have orcs in there, they can make it.
If I recall correctly, orcs are half orc, half ogre.
Mm-hmm. And we'll touch on that shortly.
Or either that, or they're somewhere in the 5,000th generation of the line, and an orc fucked an ogre at one point.
So when an orc
there's
rides,
no interbred with orcs that they just pop out now again and randomly.
When an orc rides a dire wolf, it's really a flip of a coin whether or not that becomes its next meal.
Yep.
So
and they love it.
We had a really good question here from Andrew. It says, "What is orc schooling like? I imagine not in depth, but they have a language and understand at least basic math. So surely they have something."
Yeah, and again, that also depends on the type of orc. Like a half orc, that's a flip of the coin wherever the fuck they're born. We don't need to talk about that. And the grey orcs, they have in-depth religious teachings as they are like religious fanatics. They come from a world which they already took completely over, and Grooms is, and they're the dominant race there. And as you can imagine, Grooms is pretty fucking powerful over there.
Right.
It's kind of fun.
So he likes to keep his eye on his
they basically
targets.
Teach their kids and whatnot about like kind of religion and whatnot, and some maybe math here, they're like how to count to 10. Okay. But mountain orcs don't really teach at all, really. They just whatever the fuck you can learn. They might teach you this or that, but they don't really care. Orcs, they're probably the ones that might have education centers, but it depends on the orc.
Ian, this axe, you chop. I teach you to slash tomorrow.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
So to my understanding, and Brandon can probably touch on this, about they don't really have they don't really build settlements of their own. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Orcs don't build settlements on their own. Instead, improving existing shelters with crude fortifications. They prefer to settle in natural caves or structures abandoned by others, more skillful races. Orcs can manage simple ironwork and stonework, but they are lazy and grasping, preferring to take by force the tools, weapons, and goods that other people have made.
So can you give us some kind of expansion on that? Like what is there like a popular orc, you know, area that they took over that wasn't something that they built?
Well, probably the what are the mountains called? The big ass mountains at the very top of the map.
Everest?
The spine of the world,
yeah. They've taken over a vast majority of them. In fact, that's where they've basically resided in all of history so far. And there is an orc king that's managed to get together a bunch of fucking tribes, and they have a settlement there that's about 5,000 orcs strong. And that is terrifying.
Right.
The only thing I really know about them is that the lore states that he seems to not want to go to war with a race around him, which I find odd.
Hmm.
And honestly, I suspect that he's probably not an orc and has been replaced by something or someone, and they're being manipulated.
It's a doppelganger. So we got another question here before we move on to combat tactics from forgive me if I mispronounce it, Israeli Denala?
Israel.
Israel Denal. I apologize if I slaughtered that. What type of weapons are more natural slash better suited for orcs? Because right now, that's mostly in their stat block is like great axe and javelin, yeah. And that's pretty much it.
They would prefer axes, mauls. They would prefer those over swords. Like, if they find a fancy sword, they might pick it up, but they don't have a preference for it. They prefer weapons that they don't need to be overly skillful in, and they can use their strength with.
So they don't
like
bows. That's
one of the reasons why they have javelins instead of bows, for example.
Honestly,
bow is a more strength-based weapon. They might also have throwing axes if you can get them those.
You can yeet the bolt yourself.
I'm now picturing the orcs as the Scotsman of the D&D world.
A good example of an orc weapon is the mountain orc's invention of the double-bladed axe. They just went, axe? Blade here. What if I stick blade on other end?
That's great.
More blade.
I love that. All right, so...
If I remember right, they also invented weapons of slaying.
I feel like that doesn't go... That doesn't fit the orc and invented just doesn't go together for me in my head for some
really,
reason. Like,
but I also think of it this way.
We invented weapons rock throwing.
Like, a weapon of slaying is quite literally just that specific thing. Screw it.
All right, so let's talk about some combat tactics. We're about 15 minutes in here. So we're going to start with the generic orc. We've talked a lot about the lore and stuff of orcs. So, and everything we're going to be talking about is going to be in the Monster Manual 5th edition. The orc really only has a great axe and a javelin. Those are their only two weapons. But what really lets them stand out is their aggressive feat, which means as a bonus action, the orc can move up to its speed towards a hostile creature that it can see. So to me, that needs to be the core of their combat style in the game. So the question is how do we get the most out of a great axe and a javelin and this aggressive feat? Because they don't have multi-attack, not the basic orc at all.
As in they move up to their speed,
I mean,
free?
As a bonus action, yes.
Ooh.
I mean, something to note about the orc, that's their version of a commoner.
Like, when you think
orc
about
that... Manual. That's their commoner.
Which is terrifying for real commoners. So, and they're not super bright. They got an intelligence of 7. But the fact that they're aggressive means that they can close a 60-foot gap on their turn. And that, my friend, is what makes them terrifyingly deadly.
I'm going to get you.
Like, they don't... They see a distance and they go, I'm going to go that distance.
Yeah. And what's cool, though, is I ran into one of the games I was in. The DM had 6 orcs and I ran into them and I couldn't reach them. So they all threw javelins at me. And now in my head, I didn't expect that. I expect them to all charge, which, you know, I could hopefully defend. But no, they threw javelins at me, and the javelin, while it doesn't do as much damage as the greatsword,
doesn't matter when there's 10 of them.
When there's 10 orcs around you throwing javelins, you're boned. So for me to really get the most out of these, yes, swinging the axe does more damage, but I think if you really want to make them a terrifying threat early on at a half CR, having them focus on throwing their javelins all before they run in.
This is my javelin. I named it Chuck.
The only orc that probably wouldn't do that are followers of Baktru, as they are a bit stupid.
Oh, they are?
Baktru is probably the dumbest god in any pantheon. He's so dumb, his father, Grooms, and his mother, Luthic, need to tell him how to put his avatar into play and when to do it.
That's funny. So is there any, so the basic orc, the commoner orc, as Garwin says, is kind of basic. It really just has the aggressive, but that gives them a huge advantage, especially if they ready and wait until the adventurers fall within that, because if the adventurers are hunting them and chasing them, they're going to get to the point where they're going to be limited by how far they can get, right? And so they're going to run, and then they're going to stop.
They're pretty wise.
So, yeah, they're smart. I wouldn't say the orcs are smart, but their leaders, their commanders whatever, are tactical masters. Yeah. So they would give the command to not charge in and just swing, but to throw axes, or throw their, chuck their,
throw hands.
Chuck their javelins, which I think is really, really great.
Chuck the chucks.
So, so going up from that, we've got three more to talk about. Next, I want to talk about the Orog. Because this is, in my opinion, is like the next step up, which is probably often kind of the commander of the little squads, like a squad leader. What can you tell us about Orogs?
Well, Orogs are what happens when a... What's the male orc or female? Fuck, I always get this wrong. They're what happens when a male orc and a female ogre breed. Or, at this point, whenever the fuck it happens to happen, because orcs and ogres have bred so interchangeably that an orc can just pop up randomly now.
Yeah. You get an orog and you get an orog.
They're quite hilarious, though they do have cities in the Underdark where they have actually become pretty prolific smiths and crafters. They're probably probably only the drow and the dwarves down there now. Which is also why they come with full plate, because they make that shit themselves.
And it's worth noting, too, that the Orog's intelligence is 12, not 7.
Yeah, which is way higher. Which is why, in my world, they're treated as, like, squad commanders or whatever. Because while they aren't the strongest of the orcs, like the war chief or the Eye of Grunch, the fact that they have a 12 intelligence means they can strategize very, very well. And those javelins to their benefit. They also get multi-attack. So now we can combine that aggressive with the multi-attack, which, because they got a plate armor, they could literally swing at one person, then just run and swing at another, which I feel like would make for a lot of dynamic combat.
They also got an 18 strength and con, so...
They're going to choke a bitch? What do you think, Brandon?
It sounds terrifying, and I don't want to mess with it.
Okay.
I could probably imagine an Orog running into the fray, tackling the party's biggest player, grappling him, getting to the ground, then having his others come around, and then start beating the guy up.
I think that works really well with the Orog. Because it has multi-attack, it can grapple and shove. So I can totally see the Orog running in, grappling somebody, shoveling in the ground, and then commanding all the aggressive orcs with their aggressive feature to charge to get to it and attack it with advantage while it's pinned to the ground. And that is terrifying as a player.
Yep. Stay down.
Even though their CR is low, if one of these Orogs chokes you, and then you pin them to the ground... And then it commands everyone death. And like six of these bastards who are doing different fights turn around and all charge and swing. That is a moment of, oh my God, my character's going to die. And that's where aggressive becomes so potent, I think. Where you can use weaker creatures to just overrun the power. Because even if a paladin is in plate armor with a shield at, 18 AC, and you've got six of those swinging with advantage on them, at least two or three are probably going to hit, so it's terrifying to think about. So
20 AC ain't gonna protect you forever.
No. So let's talk about the Orc Eye of Grunch. Can you tell us a little bit about them and their lore?
Well, an Orc Eye of Grunch is what happens when an orc goes onto the battlefield, kills an elf, and goes, "I killed this elf for Grunch," and then a Grunch gives them he gives them an omen, which might be an extreme headache, which is known as Grumps' head pat.
Good job.
Or some other kind of omen. And then they pluck their own eye out as a sacrifice to Grumps to symbolize his loss of an eye to an elf.
Damn.
And then they get their clerical powers. Because the grooms are clerics.
Yes. So, and that's really interesting. So, this one is actually a CR2, so it's significantly higher than a regular orc, but is the same CR as an Orog. But I would argue that these are stronger than the Orog. Not in, like, physical might, but in functionality, because, first of all, they get ringmail and a shield, so they got an AC of 16, not quite as high as the Orog, but the fact that they can spellcast makes them very potent, starting with
blessed and spiritual weapon are scary.
Oh yes, so let's get in that. So they have Groomsha's Fury, which instantly means their weapons do extra damage, which is fantastic. Though in my mind, I feel like there should be some sort of type with that. It's just extra weapon damage. I feel like there should be more to that, but you know.
Yeah, there really should be, but
that's just how it
is. Not a game mechanic.
So let's talk about their spellcasting. They get Guidance, Resistance, and Thaumaturgy. First of all, the Thaumaturgy is great for intimidation checks and really showing that it's a magical creature. But topping it off with just being able to toss out resistance to their allies is fantastic, especially if it works with an Orog or another orc to protect it. But Bless. That is single-handedly one of the most dangerous features to give to orcs. Because as we talked about, the Orog choking a bitch and pinning them down is already a problem. But now give bless to those orcs that now not only have advantage but have a D4 on top of their attack roll. You're going to demolish, even if it's a barbarian pinned to the ground. You are going to fuck his shit up. And it is terrifying. But that also means that it is more of a support character from a distance, right?
Yeah, like an Orca of Grooms, his job, support the group and yell out commands if there isn't anyone smarter around.
Yes.
That's where Thaumaturgy also comes into play.
Yep, that's really, really good.
And I'm guessing that's not a high bar to have.
That's how I see command.
Now, one of my favorite tactics with an Orca of Grooms is that when there's a particularly big raiding party and there's two of them, I have one of them have less, but then I give another Bane.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So you have one with Bless and one with Bane, and they work together, one to buff their allies, the other to weaken their enemies. Ooh, that is such a nasty combination, and I love it. Like, you're so evil.
My favorite thing to do, Bane on the Barbarian and the other strong people that are frontline fighters, and Bless on the Orok and the other orcs, and try and grapple that Barbarian down and just surround him.
I love it. And see, you go for the Barbarian. I personally would go for somebody not wearing armor at all that's not buff. So for me, when I think Orog commanding orcs to attack, he's charging after a spellcaster to choke a bitch. He's not messing around. But
like the main reason I go after the Barbarian, he's a health sponge, and he's least likely to resist Bane.
It's true. Ooh.
Yeah, he disappears like, huh. Your party just lost their meat shield. What are you going to do?
So the other thing that makes the Eye of Grooms interesting is you mentioned spiritual weapon combination. So we talked about them using spells like Bless and Bane to buff and debuff. So they're going to want to keep their distance. So using spiritual weapon allows them to engage in the combat. So I have a question for everyone. If he casts spiritual weapon, does the Grooms Fury apply to that? Because I've always had it apply. But I don't know it specifically says that.
It would apply, since I've always looked at it this way. Grooms' Fury is Grooms specifically blessing this creature. Mm-hmm. And this creature is using the power it gets from Grooms to summon spiritual weapons. So why wouldn't it?
Right.
Spiritual weapon is just Grooms' power. So why wouldn't it
be blessed?
Have the blessing the
That's a good point.
Has?
I mean, it does say
my
inner damage when it hits with a weapon attack, and it is a weapon.
No, it doesn't.
Spiritual weapon. It has the word weapon in it.
But it's not, it's not actually a weapon. It's a manifestation of a god's power. It just looks like a weapon.
If I grab a stick and hit someone, it's still a weapon.
I think he's talking about for 5e mechanic purposes.
Yeah.
I got you. I'm with you, boss.
And for the record, that is my inner rules lawyer speaking or anything else.
But the other thing that they can do is augury, which basically allows them to get insight into what's going to happen. Which I think is a very good way for a DM to fix a setting or fix a situation. Oh, yeah. So the orc, you know, prays to Grooms, gets this augury, and it says they have, You know, they have a what is it, a woe, or what's the good one?
Wheel.
Wheel. Good results. So for me as the DM, that means every DC just went up for the players. And that's the way I kind of interpret those. I would love to hear what your thoughts are on that, Garwin.
As I was reading, and a rather intriguing comment here, and he found it rather strange that half-orcs have orcish resilience, but full-orcs don't.
Yes.
That's me.
That's yeah, this guy
here. That is something that I've always found it strange, personally, because
see?
It just shouldn't be a thing. Like, they should both have it.
Right?
It's orcish resilience.
It's in the name!
Like, come on, man. Like, if you want to differentiate them, then give the half-orc something that's more, like, based on willpower or intelligence, not that. The only difference between a half-orc and an orc, literally, even physically, the only single difference is their mind. That's the only difference. There is no other difference.
Yeah.
We got an awesome question in chat here, and I would love to hear your thoughts. When Groomsh had his eye taken out by Corellian, where did the eye go?
Well, where it went initially is not really known, but one thing that is known is that Luthic eventually got her hand on it and then gave it to, I don't remember, the primordial Earth God guy to keep it for us, to keep it so that, because he was having an affair with him, so that Groomsh couldn't, you know, go after him in case he found out.
I see. That's,
Oh, yeah, Helia had it before that. She left a bunch of crumbs for Groomsh to find eventually, but Luthic got there first.
So what you're saying is I need to create a legendary artifact like the Hand of Vecna, but the Eye of Groomsh.
I think it's been done, actually.
Yeah.
Has it been done in 5e?
Good question. Let me check.
And, like, official content, maybe. Not homebrew. But, yes. Okay, so we're kind of running out of time. So, honestly, the Orc Eye of Groomsh is one of my favorites because it's so versatile with the resistance and the blast. Yeah. And the command, once again, sit, becomes very terrifying when you're surrounded by six orcs who can immediately charge after you and swat you with advantage. Like, it's terrifying. And there's just so much you can
even
do.
Look to the spellcaster in the party, if it's a wizard with a staff, and go drop it.
Ooh, I like that. Goodbye, component pouch or arcane focus.
Neil.
Ooh, that's a good one, too. I like it. All right, so let's talk about the last one in the Monster Manual, which is the Big Bad Chief, the War Chief. So, as with everything else, I noticed he's got a spear and not a javelin. Anybody else notice that?
Yep.
I don't know. Why did they do that change?
Because his name's Chuck.
It's probably because Groomsh's signature weapon as a god is the spear.
Okay. So then why don't they all use spears instead of javelins?
Because spear is more finesse than strength.
Really?
And all,
I thought they're both strength weapons. Anyways, what we want to focus on is their battle cry feature. So they get battle cry, which basically means each creature of a war chief's choice that is within 30 feet of it and is not already affected by it can gain advantage on attack rolls until the start of the war chief's next turn. This comes back, and it gets to attack with a bonus action. So this comes back to having an intelligent creature on the battlefield issuing commands to demolish one person. Because that's the problem I think that we do as dungeon masters. We tend to, there's six guys, let's spread them out evenly among the characters.
Only follows a Bakhtru would do that.
Yeah, orcs with leaders aren't going to do that. They are going to say, that's the biggest threat, attack. And they're all going to use their aggressive movement and go after that one attack, that one enemy. Which in this case is probably Brandon, because the way he's looked at me. Because that's the way they would fight. Now, some may or may not listen. You might get a few, you know, dabblers. But, they're no different than hobgoblins in the fact that they will work underneath somebody to get something done. What are you thinking about over there? He's got some interesting looks on his face. Brandon, what you thinking about?
The horrifying fury of the war chief.
Yeah. Yep. It's very terrifying, and once again, it can it has multi attack, so it can do the two extra attacks. It also can throw its spear and then charge and aggressively rush an attack, which I think gives it a lot of benefits as well. But I feel
the reason it's so strong is because all orc war chiefs are blessed by Grooms. because they managed to get to that position.
That's once again, you're throwing a spear that now also gets the Grumsh's fury, right? So everything is just better with Grumsh, apparently.
Yep. It's actually that little bit actually made me realize why they have a spear and the others don't. It's because they stand as the tribe's head, and they basically represent Grumsh's might. That's why they have a spear, his weapon.
What if the orc war chief threw his spear at one of the party members and hits them, and then the Eye of Grumsh says, uses command to say, throw it back?
That's funny. Throw it back, I need it. And deliver it. overall...
Bring me Chuck.
Overall, I really think what it comes down to with getting the most out of the orcs in the 5th edition Monster Manual is that you want to have them focus on a command structure, even if it's just one leader, and that leader is another orc. The command structure allows them to work together in unison because they're not going to do that otherwise. No. So when you're deciding and building your combat encounters, take that into consideration. Even if you're going to do 5 orcs and one orc is the leader, give him one of the feats or something to make him stand out. Give him a different weapon. Maybe he's, pretends to be a war chief and is wielding a spear and really shouldn't be. There'd be a great opportunity for lore leaking there too, right?
Yeah.
So,
Depending on what god he follows, he might have a different weapon.
Yeah, and that's really
interesting too. Ilnawald would have a longsword. Baktru would just be his bare hands. Grumsh has a spear.
Ooh, I love that. I love the bare-handed orc.
Oh yeah,
big and green, purple pants. Anybody?
Really?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we move on to our unorc tips and tricks, there, Garwin?
Orcs. They are probably the only race I've come to, like an intelligent race I've come to in D&D, that are it's probably the only race that lack the concept of racism.
Because you're all beneath them.
Oh, I was going to say because they hate everybody, right?
The thing about orcs is that their strength sexual.
Oh my god.
Like if you manage to beat them up, you're equal with us now. Now we're gonna fight you harder. Well,
let's go to my tent.
But join forces.
What's that?
There's only a single race in all of D&D that they will not help in any way. They won't even take them as slaves, and that's elves.
Know it.
The point of an elf is to die. That is its entire point. Sure.
That's great.
They don't even
that.
Take them as slaves. They just kill them.
And orc woman just walks up, punches him in the face, and is like, I seem to be aroused.
Yeah.
Usually in our society, women are a bit beneath them. That's only because in general, orc women are a bit weaker. But if a woman beats up a male orc, she's equal to the boys now. No questions asked.
I love it.
Yep.
Equal.
I'm now thinking of like the YouTube channel Dungeon Bastard, where half orcs come from. Just guys in the bar,
that
dude.
Me.
Hit that. Like done.
Wait. What kind of hit?
Yes.
Chungla.
People
her
have a strange
big as
conception
yours.
About half orcs. The only difference between half orcs and orcs is their brain, and even then. Half-orcs tend to overachieve because they're the only ones in the tribe that think they don't belong.
Yeah.
They
literally,
all feel
they're
that
the
way?
Only orcs. So they tend to overachieve, to try and belong, even though no one else there cares. They're just, dude, you're only one of us.
So I got Alicia looking for the meme that Ian had shared. he wrote up a meme, a Dennis meme that we're going to share. Start your adventure today.
Experience tabletop RPG is run by professional game masters.
Startplaying.games is the largest online platform for players to find tabletop role-playing and professional GMs for any game system and any virtual tabletop.
Are you looking to play D&D online or find a virtual Pathfinder 2E group?
Start Playing is part tabletop group finder and part games finder. Their professional game masters are running games all over the world.
We've both had some fantastic experiences with the user-friendly and intuitive platform.
In addition, the community and support are grade A.
If you're a greenhorn or a veteran role player or a power gamer, you can easily find a game that works for you and your schedule.
Visit startplaying.games today and join some new friends in your favorite tabletop RPG game, or even give a new one a try. Orc Champion, I, Dennis, challenge you to single combat.
Really? Your name is Dennis?
Actually, directly translated from Orcish, his name is Lover of Skulls, with strong annotations of physical intimacy.
Are you seriously telling me his name is Skull Effer? One of my favorite memes. Thank you, honey, for bringing that up. All right, so that'll do it for our main topic. Let us move on to our Unearthed Tips and Tricks.
And now, what you've all been waiting for, our Unearthed Tips and Tricks segment, where we bring you new and reusable material for both players and DMs.
Today, our character concept is Rowan Jeptus Bowden, who's a human. Description-wise, when his character jumped out of Wizarding College of Wizardton, the first place he went was a brewery.
Wizardton.
He drank and drank, and good lord did he drink. One of the concerned bartenders asked him what he was going to do with his life, and he replied, "Just piss it away." So his nickname became Just Piss. Eventually, he lost all coherency to his life and words. He was just a slobbering mess until put in a tight spot. The combination of pumping adrenaline and a shot of booze is just what it takes for Just Piss to perfectly recall his limited learning, and in the moment of clarity, he can be lethal. This man is a mess. But if your party needs a little bit of chaos and foul-mouth insults and guarantees some anonymity to balance out the rod-up-the-butt paladin, invite him in. With a bandolier of booze shots, or his accompaniment to spellcasting clarity.
Oh, I love that. Booze bandolier? Are you kidding me? For spells? Oh, that's
that
cool.
His personality is that Jasmus doesn't have much of a personality. Booze and drunkenhood constitute his entire worldview. Social engagement and goal in life. Slurred drunk talk, the wilder, the better. And a few choice words for any giddy-giddy that makes Jasmus feel bad about himself is all that there is to the stumbling. Swearing, sloshy, blurry-eyed wizard with a question mark.
Oh my god, fireball first.
I got a quest for you.
I need more drink.
Yeah, history. Jaspis earned a much-needed scholarship to 100% Wizards Wizarding Community, College of Wizardton. Due to his need and his potential, he initially showed promise and grades to match. But calling their professors bozos and dingleberries and know-nothings got him in hot water with the dean.
No.
The dean? Who did the dean think he was? Jaspis wondered. But his arrogance and fast temper caused Jaspis to lash out, turn the dean into a fainting goat, and leave the halls of formal wizarding education forever. The rest is a swimming, boozy fog of bloated ego, untrue drunk talk accomplishments, and scrapes and bruises from who knows where.
His motivations at the beginning, Jaspis is entirely void of emotion other than his next drink. But who's to say that he will stay that way? Perhaps the right party of adventurers will help him turn his life around. Or not. Whatever. Fuck off. Yeah, you. Don't nosh me. I'll freaking orc and fool your mom, my family, never urgish. I'ma just piss away. Dadgummit. I think the beverage tea submitted this, and I forgot to put it on here, but oh my god. It was so hard for me to get through this the first time I read it, because, and somebody, and Andrew touches on it in chat about it being a drunken master but wizard, and it's just hilarious. Yeah. So
it is fantastic.
I definitely would love to see this in one of my stories and campaigns. Yeah. Could you imagine trying to hire this guy?
Oh, just
Hire me.
Hey,
no. Hire me. Bruce,
what can you do? Fireball.
Got a quest for you. We'll give you 10 gold. Boost. I'll do it for 8.
He starts, like, haggling backwards.
But where were we offering you 10? 15!
All right, I think that'll do it for our character concept, Roland Justice Bowden. Oh my gosh. All right, our monster variant of the podcast is the Orc Drudge. Guess why I picked Orc? So you're going to start with the stat block of the Copper Dragon Wyrmling. You're gonna lose. It's gonna lose the flight, climb, bite, breath weapons, and its immunity to acid becomes immunity to poison. We're gonna give it a new combat attack called Drudge Staff. It's a melee attack that has a 10-foot reach. It's a really long staff, and apparently it does slashing damage because I didn't fix it. It does bludgeoning damage, and a humanoid that is slain by the attack raises 1d4 rounds later as a Grimlock under the orc's control. Ooh. Unless the humanoid is restored to life or its body is destroyed, the orc can have no more than 6 Grimlocks under its control at any one time. Now we're going to give it a channeling feature that recharges on a 5 or a 6. The orc uses the following channeling features. Noxious fumes. It releases a 15-foot cloud of noxious fumes that extends out from the orc, and each creature must succeed a DC 12 con save or take 1d6 poison damage and be poisoned for 1 minute. While poisoned this way, the target takes 1d6 poison damage at the start of each of its turns. The target can repeat the saving throw at the end of each of its turns to end the effect. You got ongoing damage. That sucks. And of course, it can also can release slowing spores. It's another 15-foot. It's a 15-foot cone that causes mushrooms and other fungi to grow rapidly on its victim, slowing them down. Each creature in that area must succeed a DC 12 con save. On a fail, the creature can't use reactions, its speed is half, and it can't take more than one attack on its turn. In addition, the creature can use either an action or a bonus action on its turn. Not both. These effects last 1 minute, and the creature can repeat the saving throw at the end of its turn, ending it on a success.
Oh, I love it. Especially love the noxious fume thing, because, funnily enough, that's an Grooms has an item that does that.
Really?
Something similar.
That's a happy accident, I promise.
Yeah. It's brilliant.
What do you think about...
I love these accidental hints at lore.
Maybe my body when I'm typing just knows it, but my brain doesn't connect it. What do you guys think about the Drudge Staff creating Grimlocks?
I'm not sure
what
Grimlock
is. That sounds terrifying. I just don't remember what Grimlocks were.
Grimlocks.
I've heard it many times.
Apparently, when I search it, I get dinosaurs.
Is that a robot dinosaur?
No, that's not. There's these like little
I beat
tiny.
You up. I beat. I know what happens. He beats this guy up, and this human morphs into a robot dinosaur.
It's morphin' time. They're 1/4 humanoid creatures. They speak undercommon, and they have stone camouflage, and they beat people with impromptu bone clubs.
It just occurred to me our character concept is Rick from Rick and Morty.
Is it? Once again, happy accident. But I wanted a kind of necromancer orc, and this is kind of what I ended up with. So, and I think it fills the.
Yeah, if all of your truths would be up your alley.
Yeah,
he's the orc god of death and undeath.
Oh, that's nice. I didn't
and
know that.
And disease.
Oh, that really fits in good. Yeah. What's his name?
Yeah, Yurtrus. The white-handed Yurtrus.
Okay, maybe I'll have to change this character's name.
Yeah. His priests carry bleached elf skin as gloves to, you know, follow Yurtrus's example.
That's disturbing.
That's awesome.
They're supposed to be interpreters between Yurtrus and the community, but they very often cut out their own tongue or sew their mouth shut to represent his inability to speak, which kind of hinders their ability to be communicating both ways.
I see.
How do they eat?
I don't know.
Some don't.
So I think
they just go until they die.
So I think that'll do it for our monster variant, the Orc Drudge. If you're looking for an Orc Necromancer-esque type thing, you got to check this out. If you don't know, I put lore and background story and everything and toss these together with some beautiful artwork and stat blocks for all of our patrons. Please consider and get one. Actually, Garwin can probably talk to that. I'm sure he's picked up and saw some of our monster variants. What do you think of those?
Well, I quite like your monster variant so far.
Fair enough.
So it sounds like he's waiting for one to suck. Much...
Yes, I haven't looked at them in too much detail. I've been a bit busy just, you
playing
know...
D&D.
Yeah.
All right. I think that'll do it for our monster variant, our encounter of the podcast. Now, it is worth noting this is written by Ed Greenwood, and I found it in a dungeon magazine, I think, that I was reading.
Yeah, I think you'd recognize this one.
Yeah.
Yes. It's called The Talking Door. The tall, wide, and stout front door of the Inn of the Dripping Dagger is centuries old, though it has been replaced over the years, board by board and metal plate by metal plate, as various parts of it have worn out. Yeah. For all this time, it has been unusually large, but nothing more. Now, however, it has begun to whisper short and menacing sentences.
Therefore, is it still the same door? No one is quite sure what the front door of the dagger began to speak. But it first became a concern the whole staff knew about a little over 6-10 days ago. Lady Fondera, human commoner, tried to stride in with the delivery of fresh eggs. The door whispered loudly and distinctly, "The third death will come tonight."
Fuck this place.
Why? What do its cryptic utterances mean? Are they warnings? Are they directions that might lead somewhere? Whose voice is coming from the door? The innkeeper welcomes the new notoriety and the trade it brings, but his wife and daughters want the door silenced or destroyed. What will happen if they try to destroy it?
The door is being imbued with a magic mouth spell by a spy who is monitoring the most dangerous of house games being played in the city. This can be used to weave a thoroughly engaging and complex political intrigue story.
Yeah.
Documented door utterances.
Don't worry, baby bird, I'll feed you.
Yeah, thank you.
His head will be found in a basket on Boat Street. After a century, it will awaken hungry. The inside of the two suits of armor have been poisoned. The Black Sunder slew the sixth guild member, but the seventh and eighth killed each other.
At first, I really thought this was going to be some dickhead in the basement screwing with people.
What do you guys think about this?
This is fun.
Oh, I can see quite a lot of fun things coming out of this one.
Yeah,
even with just a dickhead in a basement.
This complex investigation is just some guy that learned the message cantrip or the message spell. Yeah. Is it a cantrip?
Yeah.
Like, that's hilarious. Like, it's such a trickster.
Another thing about the Delight Fantastic, which I read this past week. Hey, buddy, how's it going? You're a tree. Yes. But trees don't talk. Oh, because you don't have vocal cords, right? Yeah!
So for me, I really like this. If you're going for the political intrigue, this is a great place to start, because not only do you have utterances that you can toss into your game, you can expand on what they mean. So this says, inside of two suits of armor, the inside has been poisoned. So that sounds like somebody's either attempting to assassinate somebody, or two people have died, and this is a clue that, oh, go look again. Oh, there's poison coated, some contact poison on it that was missed during the initial investigation, and that's how they died. That can then be tracked to a thieves' guild or something. And so I really like this. I thought it was really well done, and Ed Greenwood just writes amazing content. So,
you check out most stuff.
So we got a comment on YouTube from that says, only a monk can be a drunken master, not a wizard. That is a false statement. Only from a mechanical perspective.
Only a monk can gain mechanic benefits from being drunk.
Yes.
Anyone can be drunk and still fight, but only a monk can gain benefits from doing it.
Right. So with that, I think that'll do it for our encounter. Our magic item today is coming from Garwin. You've actually made one. Now, you can summarize it if you want, because I know it's really, really big, since it is a legendary item. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I got the idea when I looked at the Moonblade, and I saw that it's an item whose power increases the more wielders have it, so it's entirely focused on roleplay and the DM's decision on how powerful it really is. So I played around with that concept and wondered, what would Dourgothoth do if he got his hand on this item? Well, first thing he'd do is he'd go, why only elves? Screw that. Anyone can wield this thing. So, effectively, the story behind this is he at one point, someone with a moonblade came into his lair, or he went out to hunt one of these guys, killed it, took the blade back, and broke the sentience in that weapon.
Oops.
Literally just ripped it to pieces.
Oh, he killed it.
Basically. Though it's still a remnant inside the blade, and that is the curse that I call broken corpse.
Oh, that's cool. So what kind of, besides it being a curse, what does it do that's beneficial first?
Well, the Moonblade is very often put on the list as the most powerful magic item in all of D&D. Huh. If you get the right attributes for it. Because when you get it, you either roll or the DM decides on how many attributes you can put in the weapon. And then there's a table with a bunch of different attributes that you can also roll on.
Oh,
but this specific weapon here, it comes with the max of 7 attributes, and then the player that gets it just rolls on what attributes he can get. If he's lucky, he might land 7 times on the attribute that says that increases the weapon's damage by 1d6 slashing.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's a lot of fun.
So what's the curse?
Well, a curse follows around the fact that the sentience in the weapon is broken. So it technically isn't even cursed, because it's just the sentience lashing out.
Okay.
So even then, a wizard using Identify,
yep,
and also, you know, Dark Without doing stuff, wouldn't necessarily notice the curse.
Right.
Because it's just a part of the weapon. It has a sentience. All right, there we go.
I love it.
But the main fact is that because the sentience is technically dead, but it wants to be fixed because it's being wielded by someone who isn't an elf. It's breaking its original purpose.
Right, right.
Yeah. It wants to be fixed.
I love the idea of that because then I feel like it can constantly be pulling at the character to get it repaired. So then the character, and maybe the character doesn't know that it wants to be repaired. So it's dragging the person for this thing to happen. And then when it finally does, they can't use it. Yeah. Oh my God, like, that's horrible.
For example, like, due to the dead sentience inside the blade, after 1d4 dawns, the wielder will start to see an elven lady completely drenched, watery, blood dripping from her ears, her eyes and mouth sewn shut, and her once beautiful golden hair tangled and ripped as it partially hangs over her face, in his peripheral vision at night.
That's
rendering them incapable of gaining any benefits from a long rest during the night, unless they succeed on a DC 14 will save.
That's terribly inconvenient for spellcasters.
Oh, yeah.
Or anybody else, I guess, because you die. Right, right. You eventually won't be able to heal. That sucks. We had a comment that says it's not cursed, it's just a dick.
The important part is that it only appears at night in this initial stage and only in your peripheral vision, so you never actually properly see it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
I like, love this magic.
It has 4 stages. Each of them happens after a D4 of dawns.
So it just constantly changes?
No, it adds more onto it.
Ah, so it gets more effects to it as it goes. Yeah. Very cool. You'll have to send me the text of that so I can include it in the show notes. I'd like to read it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I think that'll do it for our magic item. What'd you call it?
I just have it Moonblade for now. I have to come up with a proper name.
You have to come
you
up with something.
You call it just
cool
a broken corpse.
Broken corpse. I like that. You said something about revenant corpse earlier. I liked. All right, that'll do it for our magic item. Our Dungeon Master tip of the podcast is player character origin stories, you guys. These are great. Origin stories prime new characters to step onto the campaign stage fully drawn with motivations, purpose, and direction. At their most basic, origin stories provide alternate backgrounds for a player character. Played to their fullest, they can drive a character's story, bestow them with rewards, and shape their superstructure of the campaign.
The arcs of origin stories might have as much or as little focus on the campaign as the group desires. In short, think of origin stories as character-oriented side quests that can run parallel to the plot, intersecting with it and diverging from it when appropriate.
If you're at a loss for character side quests, try reflavoring a villain in a module to match one of the player's character's enemies, and switch out treasure with the player's character's appropriate alternative reward.
Yes.
If you're running a homebrew campaign, try incorporating the player character's archenemy or rival into the ranks of your main campaign adversaries or their associates.
I really like this idea because there's a lot you can do besides just pulling. Okay, I'm a sailor. Well, that's interesting. But there's more that you can do with that. Maybe during his sailing, he found a rival that he wasn't able to, that kept getting the jump on him or something. And so you bring not up the fact that he's a sailor, but the fact that he has this rival who kept looting the enemy before he got to it, or finding the treasure first, which I think is a really cool way to do that. What do you think, Garwin?
Oh, it could definitely be really interesting.
Yeah, sorry.
This was the day you almost got ahead of Black Jack Samuels.
That's really good. What is that from? That sounds familiar.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
Ah, that's why it's familiar. I love it. It's pretty straightforward, you guys. Everyone wants to pull right from their backstory, but coming up with things that are tied to the backstory but aren't is a great way to allow to fully draw on character motivations in a new way, I think. Yeah. You have anything, Mike?
If you don't put something into the backstory which the DM can actually use, it gets hard to actually include your backstory.
Right, right.
Yeah, using elements from characters' backstories, I think, really helps bring that out in the game. Because I've done that in one of my last campaigns. I looked at their backstories, and one of my characters said, I don't want to play this character anymore. I just made it on fast character, and it sucks. And I just don't want to do it. So I said, okay, I'll kill him off next game. And I used a prior enemy from his past, and that person popped him.
Nice.
I keep picturing a rival NPC who doesn't actually do anything wrong, but he always, like, annoys everybody. And on top of that, you always try to sabotage that character, but always somehow benefits him.
That's awesome.
Sounds like Team Rocket.
Okay. So, I may have lost my arm because I got stuck in the trap, but I went to a blacksmith who was a dwarf, and I did the benefit. I now have a robot hand!
I love it. That's great. That would be a great artificer story. So, all right, I think that'll do it for our Dungeon Master tip: player character origin stories. Our player tip of the podcast is
Don't be a dick.
Nice. And you can avoid dickitude by following this awesome optimization tool called a very small problem.
Fairy.
See what I did there?
Yeah, I hate you.
This tip requires a bit of specifics. First, you need to be the fairy race, which is new, which is classified as a fae and is small in size. This is important, okay? In addition, they have a fly speed equal to their walk speed. Not a bad start, that's for sure, I'm gonna be honest. The fairy gets some pretty cool race features too, specifically fairy fire spell at 3rd level and enlarge reduce at 5th.
I've seen fairy barbarians. It's scary.
just a tiny ass fairy beating the shit out of you.
I'm thinking about it.
Because weapon
fairy
damage
really
doesn't
big.
Change when you get large or smaller.
Not in this edition.
What are you going to do, Pipsqueak?
Nope. I'm going to shove your face through your ass.
Oh, God!
You know, I'd argue that a fairy getting even tinier, but still hitting you with the strength of a barbarian is even scarier.
Yeah, I think we learned a lot of that in What If. Ooh, spoiler alert.
The Mighty Mouse.
All right, so...
Now, you need to be a bard of the College of Creation. The Performance of Creation feature basically allows you to create a medium or small object for a number of hours based equal to your proficiency bonus. Once you hit 6th level, you can use the feature Animating Performance, which allows you to bring said object to life as a companion. Wait, I would love to have a walking lamp.
Which it's just a leg that hops and follows you that glows.
Which uses a special stat block called Dancing Item. With a bonus action, you can command this item to take actions if it is capable. Or it is capable of, yes. So we create a medium chest, animate it, and then fly in and out to gain the benefits of full cover so long as the animated chest is alive.
I'm now picturing the lamp as a leg lamp from a story.
That is brilliant.
You want to touch on that?
I would absolutely hate it as a DM, but I'd love it at the same time.
Yeah. That's great.
You can even take this further by combining it with spells such as Scrying and Meteor Swarm to make attacks without actually ever leaving the inside of your protective chest. Now, what's best? If you're already inside when the battle starts, an ally can set the chest off to the side or on their back, making it extremely difficult for enemies to even know that there's another party member.
Oh, just could you imagine? You attack this part in the middle of the night. You surprise them. Yeah, you gotta beat these two bastards up. And then suddenly a meteor swarm starts falling from the sky. Like, where's this coming from? Who cast it?
And that's the beauty of it. And I mean, the full cover thing is already badass, but there's a lot of spells that require you just to see, and Scry lets you do that. So the idea of a pixie wizard stuffed inside this box is just terrifying as a dungeon master.
You don't even need Scry. Just look through the keyhole.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Just look through the keyhole.
Oh my gosh.
I see you.
Dude, you could even shoot arrows through the keyhole.
Yeah.
Like, what do they call it? A murder slot?
Still does the same damage.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I love it. What do you guys think about this? Pretty great?
Yep.
I really want to make a fairy.
All right, I think that'll...
You make me tempted to not play an orc.
Oh, I am. That's... You guys don't know, but that's a huge, huge compliment. So, I think that'll do it for our player tip of the podcast.
Don't be a dick.
And you can avoid dickitude by... taking advantage of this very small problem. Facepalm. All right. Before we close out today, we have a gift to give away for our weekly RPG Fat Loot giveaway. Brandon, take it away.
Caught at the Cross Keys, Stuart Watkinson? Watkinson?
Sure, go with
yes.
that.
Sounds the young, wealthy, and extremely obnoxious noble has been talking very loudly about the money his family has. The party will have to head to the Cross Keys Inn on the high road south of Neverwinter and bring him back unharmed. However, the Cross Keys attracts many folks, all with their own agendas. Crazed, drunken Goliaths, street gangs, thugs, and adventurers from all over Faerûn are all thrown in to make... for one wild night at the inn. This adventure gives players the option to be the heroes and save the day, or play another group of bandits looking to capitalize on the work of others.
I like that. So who's our winner today, Garwin?
It's Matt Thegis Krieger.
Mathis Krieger. That's what we're going to call it, and if that's not it, you're going to get an email, so it doesn't matter. Didn't win, no problem. Head on over to CritAcademy.com and subscribe to our newsletter for your chance to win. We give away fat loots all the time. We're always tossing out loot and dropping it off right into your mailbox. So first of all, I want to say thank you, Garwin, for not only being an Emerald tier patron, but for joining us. I've been loving our games together. He almost had us all in tears in the last game.
He only says that because he wasn't really in here. I was crying bad.
I was there. I was close. It was some amazing role playing. So thank you for giving us that opportunity.
He was doing a story. I was like, what the fuck, man?
Yep. I play by my sleep.
It's like, hey, Brandon, how's your character feeling right now? Like this.
Yeah, just like that.
Yeah.
So thank you.
I love that too. Like, great. Here at the table, there's a lack of empathy, honestly, for people that aren't yourself here, so that was beautiful happening, seeing it.
So if you enjoy the show and you'd like to support us, please visit us at CritAcademy.com, follow us on social media, leave us a review, hit that subscribe button if you're watching on YouTube right now, please. That really, really helps us out a lot. I've been dropping a lot of 1 minute TikTok videos and shorts and everything for you guys. So
it's over there.
With that, I am your host, Justin.
I'm your guest, Garvin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon. Thanks for listening.
Keep your blades sharp and spells prepared, heroes.
Understanding, you actually pronounce the J.
Really?
It's almost never silent.
Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah, I guess it's true here in most eyes, I guess. I don't know. I can't pronounce it. Math jizz.
Unless it's German, then it's Y.
Yeah. Matthias?
Krieger
could be German, yeah. Anyway,
the sound it makes is...
Just like a fairy.
Krieger.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? Ew, seriously. They squeeze the grease out of the wool and process it with chemicals, and then you eat it. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I got rid of products I didn't want anywhere near my body. I found that many multivitamins contain high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and even lacked some of the nutrients we actually needed. So what did I do? At 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. Ritual's products are made traceable, meaning we share the science and sourcing for every single ingredient. For example, our vegan vitamin D3 comes from sustainably harvested lichen in Nottingham, England, not sheep. We trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. See for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.